Kentucky is January 23rd, 2018. What is your name?
John Kellenberger.
And where do you live?
Ashland, Kansas. Veterinarian.
And how old are you?
47.
When did you first become aware of the Starbuck fire, hereafter referred to simply as the fire in general?
Actually, when I first saw the smoke within 5 miles of where it started. But then I ended up at Montezuma and Greensburg when they started issuing the warnings.
Evacuation warnings?
Yes.
Okay. So what were your first thoughts about hearing that they were evacuating?
Yeah. To start with. And I was a little bit confused where I was on your location of your phone.
Right.
I was trying to decide, okay, if something evacuating at Greensburg or something evacuating at home. But then shortly thereafter, the school called me. And then I realized it was Ashland.
So did you have something to do with...
He called me and basically told me that that's what they were going to do, you know, just so if people started questioning, I'm on the school board, and if people started calling us asking, we just knew what his plan was.
Okay. And when you were in Greensburg, where was your family, and what did they do?
They were at school and home, and as soon as that forced evacuation call came, you know, I told them to head to Coldwater, and so that's where they went, and I ultimately ended up meeting them there because, you know, I was coming from Greensburg, and they were headed that way.
So when you were at Greensburg, or at Coldwater, what could you see of the fire from there? And what were you hearing from people coming from Ashland?
Well, I stopped in Coldwater, and my plan was to get right to Ashland once I made sure the family was okay. Well, I was having trouble getting out of Coldwater. They didn't want us to leave Coldwater going towards Ashland. And right away, I started helping out with some of the elderly that were trying to get to the high school at Coldwater, and everybody was showing up with animals.
Yes.
So I helped kind of get a area in a 4-H building where we could get the animals. But during that time, I heard from 5 different people that our house had burned, either via text or via phone call. You know, somebody would call and say, hey, I'm sorry about your house. And then 5 minutes later, somebody else would call and say, well, as of right now, your house is okay. And then I'd get a text 10 minutes later that said, your house is burned. So
what kind of emotions was that going through?
It was a roller coaster. It was really hard on the kids, of course, because, you know, they had with social media. I don't do social media, so it was all just phone calls and texts. But with social media, they were hearing from a lot of friends who had heard secondhand our house had burnt. And it wasn't until much later into the night that a friend actually finally sent me a picture of our house.
Intact.
And that was when we knew for sure.
So did you all spend the evening and the night in Coldwater and return on Tuesday?
We ended up, you know, I have a number of clients/friends over there, and ended up taking Angie and the kids out to one of their houses because, you know, the high school was filling up fast.
Right.
So we went out to stay there, and then once I kind of got them all situated, I started trying to make my way to Ashland, and I ended up, I think I finally got to our house at about 4 a.m.
So you were able to check and make sure it was there, and did you have animals at your house?
We did. You know, we have a number of dogs, a number of bird dogs that are in kennels. Right there around the house, that was it, was the dogs, and then had one horse locked up in a trap. And at about right before dark, I had a friend call. He said, hey, I'm going by your house. What can I do? And I said, well, move the sprinklers, because we had the sprinklers set on the south.
Uh-huh.
I said, drag those sprinklers to the north and then just get out of there. It's not worth you.
Yeah, right.
And as he was doing that, he's talking to me on the phone, and he said, what about all these dogs? And I said, you'll never get those dogs loaded. You know, the bird dogs won't listen to him. And,
and
I said, but do me a favor, just throw their kennels open. You know, at least let them out so they have a chance. And I said, and leave that black gate open and that horse can get out. And, you know, I don't know if he will, but he has a chance at least. And when I got there at 4, the horse was standing on the concrete in front of the house, and all the dogs but one I was able to find within 10 minutes. And then it was 3 days later that one of the Giles girls found the last dog halfway between our house and their ranch.
Yeah. So did you lose any outbuildings? And
yeah, we had a barn that burnt.
Mm-hmm.
And other than that, you know, the house was okay. And the
did it get pretty close to your house, the fire?
Yeah, within about 2 foot.
Yeah. So do you have short grass around your house, or do you have a lot of trees, or
yeah,
is it pretty
bare?
Yeah,
there's a lot of trees right to the north, and
uh-huh.
It burnt into them and burnt a lot of those. My understanding was there was a fire truck. You could see the tracks that went around our house about an hour prior to the fire getting there and foamed it.
Yes.
And then a couple of other friends were there with garden hoses
uh-huh.
up until the point we didn't have water. But
is that because of the loss of electricity? Or
mm-hmm. yeah.
So are you on city electricity? Or
we are.
And
we
so
are.
If the city, or was there a line down out to your house?
There was a line down. So
were you without electricity for a long amount of time? Or
no, and it was back on by late the next day.
Yeah.
We were out, you know, and I paused because I wasn't home, obviously. I was out doing
yeah.
other things. But if I remember right, Angie told me that it came on late in the afternoon on Tuesday.
Okay, so Monday night, did you get any sleep?
No.
And Tuesday, once you checked on your place, what was your next thing that you did?
Well, Dr. Sparrow, who's my partner, and I, we met at the vet clinic first thing that morning. And we decided that, not because we were so qualified, but somebody was going to have to kind of serve as the information source and to help, you know, people disseminate information through ranchers. And so we decided to kind of make it, for the lack of a better term, a command center.
So when did you start hearing about people had lost cattle or had lost other animals?
Immediately. I mean, we knew before. You know, we knew that night that it was happening, but obviously it needed to get daylight before we could do much about it.
Right.
And so then once we decided that, he decided he would stay there and man the phones, at least temporarily.
Right.
And unfortunately, I went home to get some weapons to humanely put cattle down.
Right.
And then, you know, took off to just go see where the biggest need was, and of course, you know, you didn't make it very far.
Yeah.
You
know. So did you go west of town, or?
No, I actually started off, Dr. Sparrow and I have a bunch of cattle right up by Bo Zidens.
Yeah.
And we had people coming to deal with that, but I went up there, and then that got me involved in Bo Zidens, and then really for the first 3 or 4 days, I never got off Bo Zidens, Miller's, and Giles.
Yeah.
But we were fortunate with the other veterinarians in the practice, and K-State sent some veterinarians down that helped us. We had some friends from Great Bend that mm-hmm. sent a couple veterinarians down at different times to help us, making sure we were getting to all the clients and the cattle in a timely manner.
So was your staff making calls to farmers, or were the farmers and ranchers making the calls to you to tell you that they needed
initially,
help?
Initially, we were making the calls. But then kind of as the word got out, it was going both ways very rapidly.
So how soon did some of the veterinarians show up to help? Were they here before Tuesday morning? Or
no, I think we had K-State veterinarians on Wednesday.
And talk about some of the things they did, like at with horses and that they did at the vet clinic to help horses that survived or cattle that survived.
Yeah, you know, initially the majority of the work was to define the animals that need to be euthanized, that needed to be put down to end the suffering. And then it was kind of a staged process. You went through those, and then you went back to the ones that you knew had some injuries but, you know, could wait till we got through the initial push. And So to start with, that's what it was, because for the federal aid programs,
right,
somebody had to be there to document, to have pictures.
And did it have to be a certified person to do that documentation?
They wanted it to be. Real quick, I mean, we couldn't be everywhere to look at every animal. And we were dealing with a lot of pictures.
Right.
You know, I start telling some people, if a cow is obviously suffering and she can't get up, get two pictures of her, humanely put her down, and get the pictures to us, and we'll help compile them. And that was something else that our office help did.
So did they have a, was it easy to identify the cattle since they usually have tags, or were the tags all burned and stuff?
Most of them, if they went through the fire bat at all, the ear tags were melted out of their ears.
Yeah.
So, you know, some of them you could still usually identify a brand.
Right.
You know, but the first few days, obviously, the ones that we were dealing with were the ones that couldn't get out of pastures. And so, you know, they were, with a few exceptions, they were in the pasture that the people owned. So you know whose cows they were. With a few exceptions, there were some pastures that were mixed that, you know,
yeah,
one fence got knocked down and you had two owners' cattle together.
Yeah.
But
usually that way. Happens.
Yeah.
So those first couple of days were pretty horrific.
Yeah. Yeah, they were. I mean, even with dealing with the Anderson Creek fire, you know, that covered a lot of our practice area. And there were, the total number of cattle killed in that Anderson Creek, we saw more dead on one ranch in this fire than the entire number for all the places on Anderson Creek, and nothing to the extent. You know, the cows that were put down at Anderson Creek were not burnt, nothing to the degree that these cows were. They, you know, some of them to the point that if you didn't really drive to each cow, you would have never believed they were alive. They were burnt that bad.
Yeah.
And you know,
so were they kind of huddled all together, or did you find them out all over the place? Or
found them scattered. I mean, you know, down certain draws, you could tell the whole group of cows were going down a draw when the fire caught them. And then, you know, totally depend on how bad they were. A lot of them, their problems were they were blind.
Yeah.
And, you know, they couldn't see, so
they'd
find each other, and then they'd kind of stand together. And the ultimately, what led to a lot of them having to be put down was their feet got so hot that their toe caps were coming off. And, you know, they're just in so much pain.
And that doesn't grow back, right?
No. No, not when the hairline's damaged like that. It won't grow back, so.
Yeah. So a lot of cattle were put down, and then once they were put down, how long did it take to get them recorded and buried so that they were dealt with?
That's something that we worked very hard at with the KDHE and everybody involved, and they did a great job. Sometimes they can be challenging to work with in the sense that, not that they're being a problem, but they've got certain rules they've got to follow,
right,
and they made very quick decisions to bypass a few of those rules. You know, normally they don't want any more than a certain number of cattle buried. They've got to be so deep. They've got to have so much dirt on top of them. And it's got to be in an approved location. You know, it can't be anywhere low, you know, anything like that. And they pretty much said, rancher's discretions, stay out of cricks, you know, obviously, which nobody could do. And he said, we don't want more than 40 in a hole, but we understand it's going to be pretty easy to lose count. And so we were burying cattle within 48 hours.
So what would you say was the maximum? I mean, did they stay pretty close to 40 or in a hole? Or?
Yeah, it's hard to say because I definitely didn't see all the holes, but I'm sure some of those holes had 100 cows in them.
Yeah. So did they bury wildlife too, deer?
If they were convenient, I mean,
yeah,
you know, that was one of the biggest labor forces. The first 3 to 5 days where I was at, anybody that came, we would tell them, bring a four-wheel drive pickup, and bring a chain because we were dragging cows to central locations.
So about how far did you have to drag?
Oh, we tried not to drag them more than a half a mile.
Yeah.
You know, we'd make a new pile if we had to go much further than that. And if we didn't get it done real quick, they'd been so hot that they were literally coming apart.
Yeah.
That's why it was a blessing when they made the quick decision. We got a hold of a number of large equipment operators, from everyone from the county to one company from Garden City and some different companies, and they got large equipment in here and they started digging holes and getting them dealt with.
So about how long, how many days did it take to find all the cattle, decide what condition they were in, to bury the ones that needed to be buried, to help the ones that needed help? Is that a couple weeks or?
Yeah, it was, you know, the cattle that needed to be put down initially, most of them were done by day four. You know, there was an isolated case that a cow, you know, was in a real tough place to find or get to, but then after that, we started going back through those bigger groups of cows that had survived it, that went through it. We were going through them on most places about every 3 to 4 days. And, you know, the first time we waited 3 to 4 days, and then if we found quite a few problems, we'd go back in 2 to 3. If we didn't find many, we'd kind of put them down to go back through them in a week.
So what kind of treatment were the cattle that survived getting?
Mainly pain medication and antibiotics, you know. There's, unfortunately, the pain is the biggest thing that they're going through. And if the cattle were close enough to pens that we could get them medication without causing more suffering, you know, if you're going to have to drive them 2 miles to get them somewhere, because a lot of the pens were burnt. You know, there used to be pens there, but if they were wood, they're not there. So that was another challenge.
And if you had a trailer with a wood floor in it?
Yep.
Do you have a floor? You don't have
seen
a wood
number
floor
of people. In fact, we had people come to the clinic to pick up animals that ended up there that somebody else brought in, and we had at least two different people back up to load their cow, and when we opened the trailer, there's no floor. And they hadn't even thought about that. You know, the tires were good, so they figured
everything else was good.
Yeah.
So did you see some miracles when you went out and were checking cattle? There's some where you couldn't believe that those were alive?
Yeah. I mean, you know, I can think of two groups of cows that, you know, early on there, it just seemed like we were having to put down more of the cattle that we found than we weren't, and if they weren't already dead. And I can remember, I think it was late in the day on the second day, I had a guy call me. I was on his place, and he said, there's a group of cows north in this pasture, and he said, I don't think anybody's went to them. Hmm. So, you know, it was late in the day, and you kind of had a belly full up for the day, but I'm thinking, oh, no, you know, there's over 100 cows in here. And we went up there, and it was almost like they hadn't even been through the fire.
Oh.
You know?
Yeah.
And another place, probably about 100 cows, and over 90 of them, there was a area where a pond had ran back into some short grass, and those cows, I don't think they were smart enough to go there. I think they happened to be there.
Yeah.
And so, you know, those two groups of cows, it was a real relief to drive into some groups of cows that looked normal.
So, are you still seeing some difficulties to the cattle from the fire now, since it's almost a year later?
No, not so much now, but we did for a long time, you know, and we talked about the feet problems, but the other problems on all the cows was it burnt their udders.
Yeah.
And some of them we thought were going to be okay, but it did enough damage that internally even that the next time they calved, they didn't produce milk like they normally do. Wouldn't. Or, you know, instead of having four quarters, they would have one or two that were functional. And short of just putting your hand on every cow and checking that, you know, it just...
Was there a lot of calf loss?
Yeah.
Because, you know, this is calving season. Mm-hmm. When they were there, to lose a lot of calves.
Yeah, and a lot of guys didn't know for sure how many calves they lost.
Right.
They kind of had to come into that number backwards because March 6th, there's a lot of places that are having somewhere between 20 and 30 calves every two-day period.
Right.
So you didn't know, had she calved, had she not calved, did, you know. Yeah. So, but yeah, there was sizable calf loss.
So about how many calves that had been born before that no longer had a mother were taken to meet or to somewhere else for care? Do you got a kind of a number?
No.
And what did they do?
Well, the ones that went to Mead, that started off as a 4-H project. They were going to farm those out. Well, it kind of got bigger than the number of 4-H kids were. But,
right.
But they did, there was a lot of people that took 2, 3, 4 calves in and mm-hmm. bottle fed them and, you know, kind of took care of them because that way the ranchers didn't even have to worry right. about it. A lot of them also went to a calf ranch, you know, where they raise Holstein calves.
Right.
And they took a bunch of them out there, and they donated that service, you know, took all those beef calves in and then sent them back once they had them. Not so much once they were had the calves ready, but once the people that they left from kind of had their feet back under them and could.
So did those calves have a lot of medical problems too?
You know, they were went through pretty hard prior to going. And, you know, the calves that needed to be put down. But, yeah, we still had calves that, you know, would slough one toe cap or, mm-hmm. you know, end up with an eye problem or numerous different small problems. But
have their hide burnt off and have no cover or something?
Yeah, you know, and most of those, if they were to the point where the majority of them was burnt for humane reasons, they were put down because anybody that's had a burn on your finger knows how painful it is, and let alone to have, you know, 50 to 70% of your
right.
of your body burnt. And so for humane reasons, those a lot of those calves were put down.
So now do you have an idea of how many veterinarians or cowboys and game wardens that came to help take care of the cattle situation?
Well, I know, you know, on top of the veterinarians at our practice, and we had multiple veterinarians come in, probably to the tune of 7 or 8 other veterinarians that came to our practice. And then obviously the veterinarians in surrounding practices were helping as well, you know, mm-hmm. from Buffalo to Dodge to Liberal, you know, probably not at the same level, but definitely helping.
Right.
And the cowboy numbers was huge. I mean, it was amazing how, you know, doing what we do, we cover a big area out here, and it was amazing, you know, you'd be on a ranch and you'd see a guy that was 100 miles from home,
right.
and he just showed up with a horse saddled in a trailer and just, what can I do,
yep.
you know, and the game wardens were a blessing, and because we work with cattle every day, and we at times have to put cattle down, but when we put cattle down, it's one a month, and it's for obvious reasons, and after you put that many cattle down, I don't care who you are or what you do, it starts to wear on you. And when I got in contact with the game wardens, the first thing, I wasn't even thinking that they would be able to come help. I asked mm-hmm. for ammunition because I was out. I mean, I'd went through every personal, different guns, different, you know, everything. And, you know, he said, absolutely, I'll meet you. And so I went up there, and he hands me 1,000 rounds. And he said, can I get you a guy to help? And that was a huge help. You know, I was still there, but you didn't have to pull the trigger every time. You
right.
know, you could say that one and just kind of, you know,
yeah.
look away. And they were a wonderful help. And I don't know for sure how many of them actually came and helped, but I know most of them from this area.
Yep. So were there any donations to pay for the bullets? Or?
Yeah, you know, later it was funny how people, it's amazing how generous people were, as we all know. But it's also amazing when you get into a situation like, people tend to think of everything. You know, people were calling saying, what do you need? And, you know, of course, fence and stuff. We need labor right now. We need hay. And, you know, people were backing up to the vet clinic because to start with, they were dropping everything off there. And real quick, we decided this is going to overwhelm our space and our workforce.
Where were you putting it?
Well, on our new addition in the back, we have a big storage area.
Okay.
So we were put, I mean, we had everything from milk replacer to clothes to, and some ladies from Scott City pulled up one afternoon and they said, we didn't know what to bring, so we went and bought some feed and we bought some feed buckets and, you know, kind of just everything we could think of that around the house people would have lost. And then we went to the local gun store and we bought all the ammunition they had.
Wow.
And, you know, that's something that nobody would ever thought to tell them to.
To bring.
But
so how many cases of ammunition did it take? I mean,
there's no way I could answer that because I don't know what everybody, you know, I wasn't everywhere.
So what's a rough estimation of how many cattle? Do you have a specific or
no,
is it pretty?
There's definitely not a specific. The number that's been thrown around is 6,000 to 9,000 adults, and probably somewhere between half and that number again of calves.
Yeah.
But
and what about wildlife? Did you have any idea to any way to?
No way to know a number. I mean, I know we saw a number of them those first few days, from deer to coyotes to rabbit, you know, whatever it was that were dead or, you know, severely burned.
So you were out doing that around with the cattle, and Dr. Randall was at the vet clinic. Did he have some help there too? Did your whole staff come in and help? And did they also go out in the field and help farmers and ranchers?
Yeah, the other veterinarians did. You know, most of the office staff, real quick, they started building spreadsheets and, you know, trying to figure out ways to. And then, you know, like I say, we knew we were going to have to. And at about the fifth day, we said, okay, we need to get a community group together. And, you know, that's when they started meeting and started breaking. Okay, these people are going to be in charge of volunteer help. These people are, and, you know, we all know what Feed and Seed did. We know.
Yeah. So what about the vets, the students that came down? And from Manhattan, and I heard they had some things for equine. They did some things for horses.
Yeah, and you know, it was amazing. There weren't that many horses. The number of horses compared to cattle, of course, you know, just in the county is so much lower, but there was not a lot of horses severely hurt. You know,
what about the ones that people were riding to round up cattle? Did those horses have some injuries or have some effects from being smoke?
We had a lot of irritated eyes. We had a lot of nasal discharge, you know, coughing from, you know, we covered a lot of them with antibiotics. Drug companies helped there. You know, we had all of the drug companies that we do business with offering free antibiotics and, you know, to treat anything related to the fire.
Yeah.
So, you know, all of that was taken care of as well.
What's your most vivid memory of the fire?
Probably about 2/3 of the way through Tuesday, so the first day after the fire. You know, I had a friend, client from Liberal call me first thing that morning. He said, what can I do? I said, I have no idea. I said, I don't know. I don't know where we're at yet. I haven't been out there. And he said, well, I'm going to come. He said, I'm going to stick my ATV in the back, and I'm going to stick a saddle horse in the front, and I'll be there. And he showed up with his Ranger, you know, a four-wheel drive ATV, and he and I ended up in it all day putting cows down on two or three ranches. And we'd been in this draw, and we'd been in a pasture where there was, I don't remember the exact number, but it was 70-some pair. And we'd shot every animal. Mm-hmm. And we come out of that pasture, and we're working up the draw towards the headquarters, and, you know, coming across two cows here, three there. and we come over a hill, and a coyote trots up on the hill on the other side, and he stops, and he said, do you want to kill him? And he looked healthy, and I said, I don't have the heart. You know, none of us pass on shooting a coyote. I said, no, I don't want to shoot him. Yeah. And he ran off, and we figure out what he was doing. There's a cow in the bottom, and he was down there harassing her. She was blind, and her calf couldn't get up, and he was blind. And I've got a picture of it somewhere. The cow is literally standing over the calf, fighting this coyote that she can't see.
Right.
And,
smell it.
Yeah,
though,
she could smell it and knew that he was trying to get to that calf. And, you know, you don't shoot the coyote, you drive down there and you have to shoot both of them.
Yeah. And, it's kind of a reversal there, right, of how things go. So you said you're on the school board. While you were out doing your job, did the school call and ask for some input about what they were planning on doing, or did you find out about that?
They were trying, and I'm going to be honest, I only used my phone when I had to.
Right.
And, you know, I would try to look when it was ringing, but I'd get home at 10 o'clock at night, and my voicemail box would be full, and I'd have 180 texts, and I'd try to look through them and answer the ones that
needed
you know,
to be.
We're more than what can I do, thinking of you, anything like that. And, you know, I would talk to Mr. Wettig. I'd try to talk to him once a day. But, you know, everybody up there just did a great job of, you know, it wasn't, you know, they just did what needed to be done. And he was calling, but it was more kind of like the day he was letting out. He was calling saying, here's what we're doing. And, you know, given us as board members, a chance to say if we thought there was a concern with it, but obviously, you know, nothing that was done, you know, was wrong. It was, they just met needs.
So did you take advantage of the meals that they were preparing up there, or did you have time?
Yeah, I did probably finally on about day 3 or 4. You know, I would, when I came back through town, headed to another place or something, I'd stop and grab something.
Did you have time to go home and get a couple hours of sleep every night?
Yeah, after that first night, I mean, you know, there wasn't a whole lot to do when it was pitch black out, so we would, you know, we'd go hard till dark, and then after that, you just went and got some rest.
So, I will backtrack just a minute, because you said you were at Greensburg when you saw, that they let out school. From there, could you see the smoke?
Yes.
What did it look like?
Well, initially from there, I mean, I knew it was smoke. I knew it was a fire because I'd been hearing about this fire. But it looked more like a real bad dust storm from up that far. And then the closer you got, you know, you were smelling it. I mean, you didn't have to get very close. I was probably halfway between Greensburg and Coldwater, and I could start smelling it. And if you stopped, I remember one time I pulled over on top of a hill to talk on the phone, and you could actually see ash building up on your windshield wipers, you know, just sitting there, you know, hitting the windshield. And so, but initially, you know, when I was just north of Greensburg, it looked more like one of those days when the dust is really rolling.
Yep. So talk about the smell, like after, during the week of the fire and then after. Every day is kind of different.
You know, we were fortunate enough to get the cattle buried quick enough that the smell of them never became an issue.
Right.
And that was our biggest concern, because it was going to get to the point where it was a problem. But, you know, when I think back of, I remember it was well past 2 weeks. Finally, one morning I walked out, and I was about halfway to my vehicle before I realized I'm not smelling the smoke, you know.
Right.
But I guess as far as the smells, that's what I remember. I mean, it just became normal, you know.
Every day.
Everywhere you went, no matter where you got out,
Yeah.
And, of course, you know, after you've been out in the pasture very long, you were covered, so
yeah,
you couldn't tell if it was just me or if it was where you were at.
Yeah, because you're ash and all that kind of stuff, right?
Yeah.
So, before this, when we've had fires, I mean, you've been around grass fires and stuff like that. What's the main difference here between what's normal grass fire and what this was?
Well, I mean, you know, you've heard everybody refer to it as the perfect storm, and, you know, the humidity where it was at, you know, as low as it can basically go, the amount of fuel we had in the pastures, and the winds, you know, and not just one wind.
Yeah.
If the wind wouldn't have switched, you think about what the difference would have been, you know. But I know we're so consumed with this fire coming at us from the southwest that a lot of people didn't even know that there's a fire up here to the north. And then when that wind switched, and I still remember when I was pulling into Coldwater, a good friend that we have some cows with over at Mead called me, and he said, "I'm filling up with gas," and he said, "Can we come move cows for you?" I said, "If you can get there, that'd be great." I said, "I'm not going to be there, and I know Randall's not going to be there." And he said, "Well, we're going to try to come in from the north." He said, "Because I'm pumping gas in Mead right now," and he said, "in the last 3 minutes, the wind has went from 60 out of the south, southwest, to 45 straight out of the north." And he said, "So I'm going to try to come around." Well, and it wasn't 15 minutes later, he called me, and he said, "There's fire everywhere." He said, "I can't get in." You know, he was trying to come down through Bozidens. Mm-hmm. And he said, "I'm behind a huge fire here." And that was the first time I knew about that fire.
Right.
You know, when he said the wind switched out of the north, it was almost like, you know, it's going to blow back into itself somewhat here. But, you know, and that was the thing that I think everybody's learned as we've moved farther from it, is how many fires actually started
right
that day. You know, it wasn't just...
Not only here, but...
Right.
All through the state and stuff.
Yeah.
But yeah. So, who were some of the people or agencies that proved most helpful during the fire?
Well, I hate to mention because I'll forget them, and it's not that I'm trying to say they didn't do a good job, but, you know, to start with, the government livestock agencies that allowed these rules to be... And I don't want to say that the rules weren't followed, but that we put some common sense in place to get things done in, just like we do when there's a tragedy. So, you know, from the KDHE to the Kansas Livestock Association to the Kansas Cattlemen's to the Kansas Veterinary Medical Association to all the fire departments, you know, and any emergency personnel, the game wardens, the local and non-local police departments, you know, and, you know, the list goes on and on. Everybody that was, you didn't have to ask anybody, you know,
mm-hmm.
they were beating you to the punch. You would think, we need to get a drug company to donate antibiotics, and they'd call and say, "How much do you want?" It wasn't, "Can we do it?
Yeah.
It's coming. Just tell us
how
when
much
to stop."
Yeah.
So, you know, I can't say that we ever ran into an organization or a group that threw up big hurdles.
Yeah.
You know, some of them had to stop and think about how they were going to do it, but it wasn't that they weren't wanting to help. It was...
Right. Yeah. Okay, you mentioned the group of volunteers that got together because everything was starting to get overwhelming and somebody needed to be in control of the different parts. Were you part of that group?
I didn't make it to the first meeting because I was still in the country, but
right.
I know the vet clinic was intimately involved through Dr. Spare, Dr. Tross, Deb Fox, Rhiannon Hazen. They were all,
mm-hmm.
you know, because they had their arms around most of that information and they were sharing it with people. And, you know, I know through Dr. Spare and Kendall Kay and the guys at Ashland Feed and Seed and the people at your business, the bank, I mean, everybody, you know, found people that were willing to ramrod things. And, you know, the Christian church camp was a wonderful, wonderful outlet, you know, that all, yeah. not only did all these people come in, but they were a lot more likely to stay and help multiple days and longer because they had a place to sleep, a place to shower, and they were getting not just meals, but good meals.
Yeah. So what were some of your thoughts and feelings about all, like when you saw the semi-trucks full of hay coming in and you saw all these people? Did you ever go down to the camp and meet the volunteers? Or?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, as we started to slow down, in fact, you know, a number of nights I went down there and helped serve meals when, you know, our work was kind of caught up and kind of not back to normal, but, you know, to where we could do it more on an 8-to-5 kind of deal. You know, and that's what's amazing, you know. They came from everywhere, and, you know, a lot of them were agricultural-based, but not all of them. You know, some of them just see a need, and they go.
Stayed.
Yep.
So what effect did the fire cause most on you or on the community? Was it more of a physical effect, financial, emotional, or is it kind of a combination of all those?
I don't think you can separate them because any, you know, us included, we lost some cattle, but small numbers compared to a lot of these guys. They are livestock. They are production livestock, but these guys pour their lives into them. Mm-hmm. You know, they're more than a factory. And the when you've had that herd for that long and you lose almost all of it, you know, there's no way for that not to be emotional. And obviously it's financial. And then how do you separate those two? Because the financial leads to emotion and emotion leads to finances. And so I think it's pretty much case dependent.
How much do you think the volunteers coming in when they did, asking to help, helped people start to recover from the fire?
I think it was amazing. And I know it was so long before a lot of those guys had to be by themselves because there was volunteers here, and it would have been pretty easy to go over and stick your head in the sand if nobody would have. But you had people that were there and people in the pickup with you and fencing crews that these guys were needing to kind of keep pointed in the right direction. And I don't think that the volunteers realized how much emotional help they were giving. You know, they weren't trying to be counselors. They were just there, and they were keeping people's mind off a lot of.
Focusing toward what needed to be done. So they weren't focusing on what they lost, right?
Absolutely.
So, did the vet clinic have any counseling after this was over? Did you bring in anybody to talk to your workers or advantage of other people having something like that?
We didn't. You know, I know Dr. Spear and I both asked our employees if anybody needed anything, but it wasn't anything that we forced. It wasn't. And, you know, looking back on it, maybe we should have. I don't know. But once again, I think how much love and support and came in helped with that more than any of us realized, especially at the time.
Right.
You know, looking back on it, it's like, wow, that would have been a lot harder if I'd have been out there pounding T-posts by myself.
It's true.
And it would have just been overwhelming. And I'd have been out there by myself, and I'd have been thinking, oh, poor me. And instead, you know, you're out there with people from Ohio or from Illinois or from eastern Kansas, you know, and, you know, I think that alone was counseling, whether we realize it or not.
So can you perceive of anything positive that's resulted from the fire?
Absolutely. I mean, I think, first of all, if you were here, and if you were here, you were obviously involved. But if you were here and you were at all intimately involved in it, I don't know how you didn't see God.
Right.
And I think that's wonderful, first of all. And then second of all, the thing that kept coming to my mind was, you know, we were shortly after the point where we kept hearing this slogan, let's make America great again. And I couldn't help but get out of my mind that, you know, not all America's bad. We saw a lot of good.
Yeah.
We saw, I mean, and everybody knows the stories and probably knows who you're talking about when you mention it, but a lot of family relationships strengthened through this that either were non-existent or at best not very close. And, you know, it's unfortunate sometimes that that's what it takes, but, you know, that's another way I saw God in it, you know, that it strengthened relationships. And it made people realize that it's okay to ask for help. So,
what can you do or have you done to prepare for another emergency, whether it's a fire or tornado or anything?
Well, you know, personally, are you asking
personally,
as a business or personally?
And as a business, as a community, what, three?
You know, personally, I think that, once again, going back to the God deal, it makes me realize that I'm not in control. A lot of times... We like to think we are, but we're not in control, and He is, and we need to be prepared, but yet we also need to accept His will and live within it. And when these things happen, don't let it become an oh poor me, you know, and have you know, to find the good in it and move forward. And you know, obviously you try to have things in place that, first of all, that your family's safe. You know, so obviously you start thinking about being a little more reactive to warnings. You know, because before that day, I think all of us would have laughed if somebody told us a fire had the chance of destroying Ashland.
Mm-hmm.
Or any of our houses, for that matter.
Right.
You know, other than a fire that starts within the house. You know, no, we're going to save the house. That's not a... So... You know, it's good that you think about things like that as we move forward, but, you know, that's more on a personal note. And a business note, you know, I think it'd be pretty hard-pressed to find an emergency that we wouldn't be ready to help in one way or another and understand what needs to happen.
And so do you have some kind of scenarios set up or have talked through some things that you can do
and
at the clinic?
And, you know, there's trainings all around the state now, and, you know, they've asked us for input into those, mm-hmm. You know. What did you guys see, and what did you do that was good, and what did you do that was bad? And, you know, the big thing is ask for help.
Yeah.
Because there's no way four or five veterinarians and what we had locally was going to cover in a timely manner what needed to be done.
What about the community? What do you think we could do to get ready or be more prepared?
You know, I think the big thing is, overall, I think a great job was done. I really do. You know, even if we had one again this year, there would be mistakes made.
Right.
But are the mistakes made with honest people working hard, trying to do with the information they had what was best? And, you know, there'll be, when you look back on it, well, I should have did that instead of that. But the bottom line is to come together.
So did you go to any of those group meetings they had afterwards to kind of get input from all the people, like they had the sheriffs and the firemen and the EMTs and emergency and some of that, kind of get together and figure out what was good and what wasn't? And
we definitely went to some of those, and once again, not all of us went to any of them, and we tried to get somebody to most of them.
Had a representative
right there.
So what about your children? How did they come out of this emotionally? And,
you know, once, especially for the two oldest ones, and I would have had a junior, an eighth grader, and a fourth grader. the junior and the eighth grader, once they knew the house was okay, and they seemed okay with it.
Mm-hmm.
Our youngest, who is a fourth grader, and I'm sure, I don't know at what age that stops, and it's probably not a magical age, it's different for each kid, but it really affected him.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, a fire whistle to this day bugs him a little. And if he hears red flag, you know, fire warning on that, he's wanting, when he goes to school that day, he asks a lot more questions. You know, he doesn't say, I'm scared, but he wants to know, Mom, are you picking me up today? Or, you know, where are you going to be today? You know, all those things that, you know, unfortunately, we hope our kids don't have to worry about. But,
yeah,
you know, and, you know, we've just tried to reassure them through it that, you know.
So I hear the school has kind of a text type thing that they send out to all of their students and to the parents and stuff.
Yeah.
Did that come in handy during the
Absolutely.
Fire? And afterwards, maybe?
Absolutely. I mean, it's a wonderful way to disseminate information like that. To, you know, it can go email and text,
mm-hmm.
and they can, you know, they can have the message out to everyone.
Yeah. So did your kids help up at the school when they had the firemen here and fed people up there?
Yeah.
Did
they
to meet some of the firefighters?
They did. And, you know, of course, shortly after we had them engaged on rolling fence up and stuff at our place. But we had volunteers show up to help at our place. And, you know, they worked side by side with them. And so it was definitely impacting on them. You know, I can remember numerous times them saying, they came all the way from Ohio. You know, it really opened their eyes to, you know, I think most of us, probably in the United States, not just Ashland, when we think of mission work, we think of Africa. We think of South America. But mission work can be outside our door.
Yeah.
And it can be in the next state, or it can be in Ohio. And, you know, they really saw what it means to serve, you know, because obviously they're leaving stuff at home.
You know. Do you keep in touch with any of the people that came and volunteered?
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, I know I do. And, you know, there was one veterinarian that came, and he's a retired veterinarian, and he's been back three or four times, and we talk quite a bit, and then a number of other volunteers, you know, get a text or an email from time to time, and so it's, you can see the networks that are being built, that I guarantee you, if those people are in a jam and we know about it, There's going to be support going their way.
Yep. So I saw recently that the veterinary clinic received an award. Can you talk a little bit about that?
Yeah, we got an award from the KVMA, which is the Kansas Veterinary Medical Association, and it's just a distinguished service award, and for mainly what we did during the fire. But, you know, like I tell everybody, we were put in a position. And fortunately, it would have been very hard to do much if you were in a practice by yourself. You know, if you were one, we were blessed that we were a larger practice. We could spread out why people were coming to help, you know, and cover a little more ground. But, yeah, and that allowed us to do more because, you know, you could cover a little more bases, and some people could be getting some rest while other people were burning the midnight oil.
Yep.
But I don't think we did a whole lot different than a lot of people would have did.
Yep.
It's just where we live and we
circumstances.
Were put in a position. Yeah.
So have you been to a lot of conferences or seminars where you've been the speaker and told of what you've done? Or
I've did a few.
Been
Dr.
on a
Spare
panel?
Has probably did more.
Yeah.
And, you know, and it's more, A, people wanting information, and then B, people wanting to learn, you know, what are the do's and don'ts.
Yep. So have you gotten some good questions from people, or had something asked that you didn't think about, or it wasn't something that, you know?
Yeah, I mean, you know, we've had great questions and some things that you dealt with that you didn't even really think of, and they kind of pointed out that you were dealing with. But, you know, the one thing that has come up is, can we figure out something to feed cattle to humanely euthanize them?
Yeah.
So when you have, you know, the problem, and that's a great idea, and it needs to be looked into, because if we get into some disasters, the cattle might have to be destroyed that aren't noticeably sick, you know, if it's an infectious disaster or something. So it would be a wonderful tool there. You know, like I pointed out to them here, the cattle we were euthanizing, we're not going to eat. They just weren't, you know.
Yeah.
They were in that much pain, you know. It's not like we could, you know. But,
and they couldn't see, right?
Right. So, you know, things like that that are coming that people are thinking about due to the numbers and the devastation that we saw, you know, are definitely going to be other good things that, and good questions, you know, that need to be looked at.
Yeah. So, do you have any other thoughts or anything that you'd like to share? Something that
I think we've pretty well covered it.
Okay. Thank you very much for telling us your story.
Thank you.
Okay, I got some pictures that you might find here. I don't know if they're all the same way. That is the smoke screen.